Every 5 years or so, our nation comes to grips with the state of its agriculture and passes a new farm bill. 2007 is one such year. The debate over this year's farm bill will likely include a well-organized effort to ban the inhumane treatment of animals. This leads us to ask, can the animals we raise for food be raised humanely?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 532nd edition of the Food Chain right here on News Talk Radio. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends way down there in Punta Arenas who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio, with engineer Dave Michaels on the boards. Hello, my Dave.
Glad to be here.
Producer Carol Stafford on the phones. Hello, Carol.
Hi there.
Folks, once every 5 years, our government passes a new farm bill with the intent of keeping our agriculture viable and healthy in a rapidly changing world. We taxpayers have a lot at stake in this farm bill, over $100 billion a year. And whenever and wherever there is a pile of real money like that laying around for the taking, there will be a debate, and there is a debate this year. This year, we're likely to hear a debate on how animals are treated, the animals we raise for food. Among the items being debated, a requirement that the federal government, including the school lunch program, buy meat or dairy products from producers that meet certain animal welfare standards, including adequate space in barns for hogs and poultry, a permanent ban on slaughtering downer cattle or hogs, animals that are lame or ill, and a requirement that the USDA set standards for the humane slaughter of chickens and turkeys. And so today we ask, can the animals we raise for food be raised humanely? And here to help us find an answer, we have Eric Nelson, who's the Region 4 Director for RCAF USA. Eric, welcome to the Food Chain.
Good morning.
RCAF USA. What is RCAF USA for the folks out there who've not heard that name before?
Well, the acronym stands for Ranchers Cattlemen's Action Legal Fund, United Stock Growers of America. And it was a group that was formed back in the mid-90s just by a group of cattle producers that had gotten together and decided to throw some money in into a fund to do some lobbying work on their behalf. And then within a few years, it turned into a membership organization. And that's led us where we are today. It's a national group that has a board of directors from all around the country, and we've got somewhere in the 14,000 or 15,000 member range as far as numbers.
Well, we always like to ask who pays the bill, who pays the way for you.
Our dues and donations from our members. You know,
dues and donations for members. Okay.
Yeah, we're quite a bit different. There's another.
Not getting a chunk of money from the Exxon Corporation, huh?
No, and the other large organization that represents cattle producers, the National Cattlemen's Beef Association, they actually offer seats on their board of directors. For if you give enough money, they'll actually give you a seat on the board. And our organization is not that way. It's each member has a vote, and it makes it trying at times because we. Have to come up with enough money, but we keep here as far as what issues we're working on, and it's the membership and the issues that are important to the members that we're working on.
It's one of those messy democracies, right?
Yeah.
Well, we have to ask, Eric, what's for dinner?
Actually, I shouldn't say this, but I think my wife has chicken in the oven today. So I hate to admit that, but we actually. We support all of the...
And your members are going to be hearing this one. You're going to be in trouble. Well, let me ask you really quickly, just give us a thumbnail of what you think. Can the animals we raise for food be raised humanely?
Oh, absolutely, and I think they are. You know, the big question and the big paradox, I think, comes in is who gets to decide what is humane and what isn't. I mean, you go back to biblical times, and animals have been beasts of burden since the beginning. Mm-hmm. And I would make the case, you know, I'm 45, I'll be 45 years old here in a few months, and I believe that animals are cared for very humanely, and there's been great advances made in my lifetime to that, and the climate controlled nature in which we've raised animals and protect their safety is one example. And and also an interesting situation we find ourselves in as animal producers here in this country. We have quite a few regulations that we have to adhere to that other countries around the world don't have to. And it is interesting, on imported meat, for example, that comes into this country, that meat has the ability to use antibiotics in those foreign countries that we're not able to use here. Right. And we may even be able to be more humane were we able to use some of these antibiotics that the FDA has deemed that we shouldn't use here.
Okay, so basically you think that we can be humane in the way we raise our animals for food.
Absolutely.
Okay, good. Also with us today, we have Wayne Pacelli, who is the president of the Humane Society of the United States. Wayne, welcome to the Food Chain.
Thanks for having me on.
Pleasure. Humane Society of the United States. I think most of us have heard of the Humane Society of the United States. And I just was handed something very interesting by producer Carol Stafford, who said that the Humane Society, the Royal Humane Society, founded in 1774, was originally founded to rescue drowning persons. Do you ever hear that one before?
Yes, I have heard that. Yes, one of my colleagues at HSUS shared that with me not long ago, and I thought it was an interesting issue. And, you know, in fact, there's a movie coming out this weekend called Amazing Grace. It's the wonderful song Amazing Grace.
Right.
And it's the story of William Wilberforce, who was a 18th and 19th century abolitionist, and he was the one who led the fight to abolish the slave trade in the United Kingdom and its participation in the worldwide slave trade. And he was actually one of the founders of the Royal SPCA, the Royal Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals. So
Good. That's
our, you know, a lot of history about the founding of the humane movement today.
Well, your organization, the Humane Society of the United States, has been growing by leaps and bounds, if you'll pardon that poor excuse for a pun. But it has been growing hugely over the last decade or so. To what do you attribute this incredible growth, Wayne?
Well, I think Americans are fascinated by animals, and it would be a rare person to come across who would say that we don't have responsibilities to animals, or that animals should be or can be treated inhumanely. It's almost a universal value to accept that animals must be treated humanely. And we have so many connections with animals in society. Two-thirds of homes have pets. There are 80 million Americans who are bird watchers. There are hundreds of millions of visits to national parks and state forests where people go to see wildlife. So I think that whether you're a child or an adult, wherever you live in this country, male or female, you know, there's a fascination with animals. And I think that the Humane Society of the United States is a place where people of conscience can come together and work in an organized fashion to improve the lives of animals in this country, whether it's domesticated animals like dogs and cats, mm-hmm. or farm animals or wild animals. And a lot of people think the Humane Society of the United States works just on dogs and cats, and that's a birthright of the organization. We do a tremendous amount of work in that area. But we're really there for all animals. And animals on farms, that's a hugely important issue to the organization.
Well, let me ask you this. Who pays your way?
We have 10 million members and supporters of the Humane Society of the U.S. We get almost no government funding. We get very little corporate funding. And that allows us to be responsive to the real interests of our constituency. And wherever you go, wherever I go across the country, there are HSUS members. And it's a real privilege to be able to work for an organization with this mission, and that is a member-based mm-hmm. organization.
Well, I've read that you guys are pulling in about $140 million a year with the Humane Society of the United States. That makes you a very powerful organization, does it not?
I hope so. I think, you know, I hope that our power is not just because of the money that we raise, but because of the strength of our ideas. I do believe that, you know, so many $5 and $10 and $20 contributions, you know, times, you know, millions of individuals, means that we're truly a grassroots organization, that we represent the common interests of people all across this country. And the interest is simple, to see that animals are not subjected to cruelty and abuse, and to celebrate animals, and to celebrate the positive relationships with animals.
We have to go to a break right now, but do you think we can raise animals humanely?
Well, I think that there are various, you know, grades of that. And,
okay,
you know,
okay, we'll pick that up when we come back.
Okay.
Folks, this is the Food Chain. Michael Olson here. Today we're talking about the animals we raise for food, and we're talking with Wayne Pacelli, who's a president of the Humane Society of the United States, and Eric Nelson from RCAF USA, headquartered up in Montana. And, of course, we're talking with you. What do you think out there? Can the animals we raise for food be raised humanely? Pick up your phone and join us today. We're at 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. This is The Food Chain. I am Michael Olson. We will be right back. Well, what do you think out there? Can we be humane in the way we raise our animals, that we raise for food? We're curious to know what you think. Pick up your phones and join us today. This is The Food Chain, and our phone numbers are 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. We're talking with Eric Nelson, who is a director of RCAF USA, which is a cattle raising organization headquartered up in Billings, Montana, which is my hometown. Also, Wayne Pacelli, who is the president of the Humane Society of the United States. Where are you headquartered, Wayne?
Washington, D.C.
Washington, D.C. is a good place.
Yeah.
A good place to be. Well, Eric brought up something that I'd like to pick up. He said that we really made it much better for the animals that we're raising. Is that kind of what you said, Eric?
In many ways.
In many ways, okay. So what I wanted to pick up was the industrialization of the way we raise our animals, so the animals we raise for food. When I was raised on that farm back there in Belfry, Montana, you know, the animals on the farm were pretty much all members of the family, as it were. And when we went out to butcher a hog or butcher the chickens, I guess pretty much all of the animals were witness to what was going on there. But it's a little bit different now. We've taken the animals off the farm, as it were, and kind of put them in factory-like settings. How has that industrialization changed the way we raise our animals? Is it more humane? Is it less humane? Eric, let's start with you.
Well, I guess, you know, it all comes down to what a person's opinion is of how high a level of thinking these beasts of burden actually have, and to assume that they have the same emotional level as humans, which I think there are some that some of your listeners out there that may think that they do, when in fact they don't. And I've got some examples that I can relate to that. But just for example, in the raising of hogs, I've raised hogs in my past, so I'll address this. You know, mother hogs, referred to as sows, if they're raised in a very uncontrolled environment where they're not separated from the other mothers and their little pigs, can be quite harmful and can do harm very easily to the other pigs. And quite frankly, that's why the use of crates for the actual, you know, the mm-hmm. the raising of the smaller pigs came into vogue, because it was the way basically to keep them alive.
Keeps baby pigs from becoming breakfast, right?
Well, right, or being stepped on or whatever. And so I guess, you know, in another example, we have a small sheep flock here, and we raise them very humanely. I mean, they run loose, and we have just small little pens that you know, they run free in when they're having their lambs. And my 14-year-old son had a ewe that had a set of twins a couple weeks ago, and did a lot. It was about 20 below zero, and was working vigorously to try to save both of those newborn lambs, and he had them both revived and were doing very well, and then the mother promptly stepped on one of them. Nothing that he could do, and that's what animals do, right. And they don't have a high level of thinking, and it can be helpful for their own livelihood to have them in a controlled environment.
Okay, well, good. Let's fire the question to Wayne Pacelli.
Well, I pretty strongly.
Just a quick intro. You were just victorious down in Florida for getting rid of these hog crates, correct?
Yeah. I mean, yes, indeed. And I mean, let me just address some of the comments made by Eric. I mean, the Humane Society of the United States, and I think most other animal organizations, don't base our ethical construct on an intelligence quotient per se. I mean, we concede that human beings, you know, have capabilities that exceed.
I don't know if I would concede that, Wayne.
Right. Well, and so it's in certain areas, you know, we can create poetry or produce a sonnet. We can also create nuclear weapons.
Nuclear bombs.
Intelligence can be used in a variety of ways. But the issue, you know, for us is that these animals have the same spark of life that we do. They have the same will to live, and I think most importantly, they feel pain and they suffer like we do. I personally believe that humans are part of the evolutionary process, and that we came from other animals and we share basic characteristics with them, nerve endings. And
you don't believe in the notion that man was given dominion over the animals?
Well, I do believe that there are, you know, traditions in certainly in Western culture and in cultures around the world where we, you know, do have responsibilities. I think those are, you know, cultural traditions. But I believe that animals are sufficiently similar to us in basic respects, specifically the ability to feel pain, that we should do our best to avoid inflicting pain upon them. And the idea that Eric mentioned that, you know, pigs will sometimes, you know, kill other pigs, or a sheep steps on a lamb. I mean, if the test is intra-specific aggression or clumsiness, I mean, my God, we have world wars, we have violence in our communities as a human species. I don't think that is a very good moral test to determine whether animals should be, you know, considered at a lower threshold. If total violence was the issue, I think we would be, you know, in trouble in terms of an ethical scale. The issue is that animals can feel and they can suffer. We have 50 state anti-cruelty statutes in this country that codify the basic notion that it's wrong to needlessly and gratuitously harm animals.
Eric, you wouldn't disagree with that, would you?
No, I you're talking to, you know, someone that spends most of his waking hours ensuring that the welfare of his animals is a good one, because that's my livelihood depends on that. And that producers in our organization will get together at times and talk about these kinds of issues, and we're chagrined often by the fact that we're painted out as indiscriminately handing out pain to our animals that are in our care. And actually, we have every reason to minimize that, and that's why I use the example of hog producers over time.
Right.
You know, I mean, if you end up with more baby pigs that are alive at the end of a 6-month period, obviously you've inflicted less pain on some of the animals.
But Eric, that's a very narrow definition of what is humane, number of piglets born. I guess I'm quarreling with you on this intelligence idea and on that idea that you're advancing. I mean, I think you would agree that even within the human community, certain people may be capable of more intellectual activity than others. I mean, certain people are better at certain things, but should we base our moral hierarchy and our moral decision making on how much of an intelligence quotient people have? I don't think you would say that, would you?
Well, I didn't come on the show to really discuss the human intelligence. That's really not what, you know, we're here to talk about the animals and specifically farm animals and their, you know, I guess their ranking in society. And
right, but that relates to humans and how, why do we value individual humans? I don't think we value them because they possess, you know, X level of intelligence. We value them because they have autonomy, because they suffer, because they have a will to live. It's much more complex than just intelligence. I'm saying that the same standard should apply to animals.
If we see animals as humans, can we eat them?
Well, I don't say that we see them as humans. I'm saying that all of these issues are matters of degree, mm-hmm. and that.
Oh,
that
well, good. Of, okay, there we are.
Yeah. In terms
so
of
where, the question then becomes, where do we draw the line?
Yeah.
What is humane, right?
Right. Well, in terms of the capacity for suffering, animals generally are our equals. I mean, we probably don't have much more, you know, pain sensitivity than animals, than certainly the higher mammals and birds do. And I think that animals are equal in the sense that, you know, they want to live just as much as we do. And the question for us is, because we do have power over animals, because we can control their lives, what are the human responsibilities that we have? And just kind of circling back to your original question.
Just a sec. Hold that. We have to come back from break. And when we do come back from break, we're going to go to Roger on the line, who has the inevitable question of the day. So do stay tuned for that. Folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here. The phone number's today, 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Can the animals we raise for food be raised humanely? What do you think? Right back. Welcome back out there. Michael Olson here. This is The Food Chain. Today we're talking about animals, the animals we raise for food. Now, I'm sure most of us have animals. I do. I have my daughter has a dog named Artie, and she gets an awful lot of humane treatment, but it never seems to be enough humane treatment. Though we feed her from the same table that we eat at, she always seems to think that she should sit at the table with us. And she'll never be happy, I know, until she's sitting at the table with us eating breakfast. Does that sound about right, Eric?
Yep.
Right.
One of our cats that frequents the front step managed to sneak its way in the house at breakfast time today, so, and was under the table for just a few minutes. We don't believe in pets in the house, but once in a while the favorite ones make it in.
Yeah, they have a way of getting in. How about you, Wayne? Do you have a pet?
You know, I don't.
Oh, Wayne, you must have a pet.
Well, I've had them my whole life, but I'm on the road probably about 60% of the time, and I would think that I would be neglecting them. You can't have the president of the Humane Society of the United States having pets and then not being around at all. I have to set a good example.
There you go. Well, folks, the question of the day, can the animals we raise for food be raised humanely? Interested to hear what you have to say. The phone number is today, 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. We're going to go to Roger right now, who has the what will probably be the question of the day. Roger, go ahead.
Hi, Mike. Hi, guys.
Hi there.
You know, it's a great show so far. Am I there?
You're here.
Okay, good. Great show. I like the little bit of sparring between guests, you know, friendly, of course. And the last comment about, you know, animals being part of my life, of our lives, was brought home to me recently because, you know, a cat, you know, which I've had for years, died. And, you know, the question was for me, you know, as the cat was dying, do I go and put it to sleep or do I not do that? You know, how to be humane, you know? I think we can't help but anthropomorphize these, you know, friends that we have in our lives.
Right.
But anyway, that's not the topic that I called about. During what I call the Buddhist phase of my life, I was a vegetarian. And part of the reason is I, you know, believed, and I still feel a lot that way, that these are sentient beings, you know, and I agree with the sentiments of one of the guests that, you know, they can feel the pain that we feel, even if they aren't as intelligent.
I would bet both of them have that same notion. Eric, you probably think that way as well, don't you?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, okay. I didn't mean to, you know, belittle one of you, okay? So, you know, I was a vegetarian for 3 or 4 years. Then I, you know, did what I do for a living. I got back into eating meat because I cook for a living and, you know, work with, you know, meat. And it's always on my mind, you know, how the animals are raised, but it's also on my mind because inevitably, if you're going to eat an animal, you have to kill it. Okay? And this has sort of gotten on my mind again recently because I was forwarded several links on the internet to some YouTube videos that showed the killing of, you know, animals for food. Now, these videos were videos of halal killings and of kosher killings. And I couldn't help but think that this was gratuitous violence against these animals. It wasn't necessary. And so there's, you know, this may be a little too provocative. I don't know if you want to go here, but how, you know, do you deal when you have cultural customs of, you know, since we have so many different cultures in the United States, but there's certain, you know, cultures where this ultra, you know, inhumane, in my mind, violence is condoned against, you know, these animals.
So maybe a question, is there a humane way to kill an animal?
Well, no, that's not the question. Mm-hmm. The question is, how do these, you know, the Humane Society and I forget the, you know, the group name of the other fellows, you know, group.
RCAF.
Yeah, okay. How do they deal with, you know, sort of, what would you call them, subcultures, you know, that basically their religion forces them or encourages them to kill animals in an extremely inhumane way. I mean, if anybody...
Would you describe what you're talking about with respect to inhumane way? What do we...
Well, what they do is the rules, you know, as I understood them from, you know, the commentary on these YouTube videos, was that they had to, you know, kill the cow. It was a cow. Obviously, it wasn't a pig because both of these cultures don't eat pigs. They had to make one slash at the throat, and then the poor beast, you know, was totally conscious. Blood was going everywhere. It was thrashing around. And the rules, according to this, you know, this video, were that, you know, in halal and kosher killing, it's one slash to the throat with some religious invocations made. And then, you know, and watching the cow die, I mean, I've been present at, you know, butchering, like a hog butchering, you know, sure, down in Louisiana, where they shot the hog in the head first, then they cut the throat and bled it. And so the hog had lost consciousness instantly, whereas these animals did not lose consciousness. Their death throes went on for minutes, maybe 10, 15 minutes, until they finally lost enough blood that they lost consciousness.
Yeah, I mean, the issue that you're pointing to is religious slaughter, where they are seeking an escape clause on the federal requirement for stunning prior to slaughter. And I think that's the issue that he's referring to. Is
right. So you know, I just want... I'll get off the phone here, but I wanted to know how you people deal with that. I mean, this is a, you know, a fairly big topic, you know, if you're talking about humaneness, because there's humaneness in raising the beasts, mm-hmm, and then there is humaneness in preparing them for food. You know, they,
yeah,
have to be killed. So what do you do?
Good question, Roger.
I'll
thank
get
you
off
so
the
much.
Phone and let you guys run with it.
We'll run with that awesome Great. Question. Okay, who wants to take this?
Well, this is Wayne from the Humane Society, and again, I would refer folks to our website, humanesociety.org, for insight on a lot of the issues. I mean, we could, as a caller suggested, there are lots of issues here. You have production issues, you have transport issues, and you have slaughter issues.
Well, let's talk about slaughter issues. You know, how do you deal with these different customs for killing?
Mm-hmm.
And is there a humane way to kill something?
Well, there is a Federal Humane Methods of Slaughter Act, and unfortunately, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, which enforces it, has chosen not to include poultry, turkeys and chickens and other fowl,
mm-hmm,
to be included under the protection standards of that law. And that law stipulates that animals need to be rendered insensible to pain prior to slaughter.
Oh.
And as Eric knows, if we're talking about cattle, there's a captive bolt gun that is used for stunning purposes before the animal is actually killed. And there are similar, you know, standards for pigs, but for poultry, again, and Eric mentioned, you know, in a way that he's having chicken tonight, and a lot of Americans more and more are eating more chicken. And when the Humane Slaughter Act was passed in the 1950s,
that was
the amount of chicken consumed was much less. So it raises very fundamental questions. We are pushing the Congress to include poultry under the standards of the Slaughter Act. Now, whether it is in the ultimate sense humane, you know, obviously I think animals have distress during these processes, the transport process, the gathering process, and you know, what we're trying to do is that to see is that if the animals are going to be killed for food, that at least they'd be rendered insensible to pain prior to that.
Okay, folks, this is the Food Chain. Michael Olson, right back. 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. We'll ask Eric what he thinks. Do stay tuned.
Get this. The average acre of farmland in or near the city limits may earn in excess of $123,000 per year. To learn how so much can be earned from so little, pick up a copy of MetroFarm, the guide to growing for big profit on a small parcel of land. MetroFarm is the PMA Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner by Michael Olson that contains over 500 pages of photos, charts, checklists, illustrations, and in-depth interviews. MetroFarm will teach you how to develop a strategy, survey markets, select crops, organize business, establish production, prepare for market, and make the sale. MetroFarm will teach you how others just like you earn a good living by growing high-value specialty crops for people who are truly appreciative. Abraham Lincoln said, "The greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living from a small parcel of land." Get in on that future today. Pick up a copy of MetroFarm at bookstores, lawn and garden supply stores, 1-800-624-BOOK, or at www.metrofarm.com.
Well, can we? Can we kill an animal that we intend to eat in a humane way? Is it possible to do that? I was thinking back to that farm that I was raised on in Belfry, Montana, and it seemed like every time we went out to do some butchering, and I know looking back across all the years, it seems to me like every animal on the farm knew what we were about that day. And it seemed like they all looked at each other and said, who's next? And animals do know pretty much what's going on when it comes to do the killing. Or am I just anthropomorphizing, Eric? What do you think?
Well, I know Wayne made the comment earlier that these animals want to live just as much as we do. Well, I guess I haven't had one tell me that.
Uh-huh.
Not to minimize the importance of the lives of these animals, but for us to look at an animal and assume, as you did, it may be, you know, maybe you look back on it with some melancholy attitude, but I don't think that we can assume that they knew just exactly what was going to happen. But addressing the last caller on the religious grounds, you know, there have been animals slaughtered per religious requirements for thousands of years.
As long as there's been religions, right?
That's right. And I guess, you know, there's probably been times where society has thought that we've really advanced in our thinking and that you know, we've got to save, you know, we're gonna save these people from these terrible things, but I'm not sure that it's someone from outside of those people with those beliefs to be, you know, it's kind of anti-American in a way. I mean, we're a melting pot here. It's why a lot of people of different persuasions ended up here.
Mm-hmm. Well, see, Eric, that's where I disagree with you. I think it's very American to talk about standards in society. Our country was founded on certain principles of justice and fairness, and over time we've seen those principles extended, you know, to women, to people of color, and I think the question now is,
chickens.
Should there be social standards and societal standards for how we govern our treatment of animals, or should it just be, you know, each person does whatever he or she wants, a completely pure libertarian sort of approach? And I think that we've already gone down the road of having standards in society for how we treat animals. That's why we have cruelty statutes that proscribe people's behavior in certain areas. And the question is, should we have more standards in agriculture? And let me just say that RCAF, I think, has been I certainly have had a very positive view of RCAF and its work on country of origin labeling and a variety of issues that it has focused on, kind of as an answer to the National Cattlemen's Beef Association. But on the issue of standards, I mean, we're focused at the Humane Society, yes, on some of the slaughter issues, but we're particularly concerned about the bulk of the animals' lives, the production phase, where young male calves raised for veal are kept in small crates, and now, fortunately, major producers are shunning that and saying, no, we're not going to house these animals in two-foot-wide crates. Voters in Florida and Arizona banned keeping sows, breeding sows, in two-foot-by-seven-foot cages for the preponderance of their lives, and many producers are moving away from battery cages for egg-laying hens. Those are the big debates that are happening in the Humane Society's world these days and a lot of the policy circles, and I don't think we just leave it up to producers entirely. I mean, we want to embrace producers who are doing the right thing and learn from them and hear the views of producers, but there's more in society than just those views. There has to be a broader social debate about how animals should be treated.
And speaking of that debate, we're going to go quickly to Humboldt County and talk with Gail. Gail, welcome to the Food Chain.
Hi, Michael. Thank you for the great program today.
Thank you.
I have a couple of comments, and then I wanted to relate something that just happened here in Humboldt County, which is right on point. First of all, I'm a vegetarian for 25 years, vegan for 5 years. I was brought up the way most other Americans are, with meat. For your listeners, if anyone wants to know what really happens with the great American food machine, read John Robbins' book, Diet for a New America. As to Eric, I hope one day that the consciousness of people, which it seems to be going in the direction of realizing, A, we really don't need to eat animals. We don't even need animal products. Your business, Eric, is all profit-driven, and that's fine.
Aren't most businesses profit-driven?
Oh, yes, okay. Yes, and I think that's just fabulous. But as to the discussing the laws on slaughter, et cetera, I happen to be a paralegal. I've worked in the legal field for a long, long time, and I'm privy to the books that are out there now on what is happening, the changes that are happening for our fellow creatures. And just as laws changed in response to many years ago with the slavery issue, I believe that we are heading in that direction, that people are not going to put up with any form of inhumanity.
Well, that's a great question, because that's, we got to take a quick break right now. So give us your question really quickly, and we'll pick it up after the break, okay?
Well, I'm looking at a Life magazine photograph, March 15th, 1998, out of Hanoi, Vietnam. These people, just as passionately as we Americans eat beef for chickens, there are about 10 dogs in a makeshift cage, it says, bound for the table. So they are going to eat these dogs. They are going to put them in sacks and smash their bones and flesh so that they're tender. Mm-hmm. And so my question is, doesn't everybody believe that there is no amount of cruelty that cannot be rationalized when we humans want to eat something? So I wanted to relate the story.
Hold
that
on, and I'll pick
here.
You up. Hold up, and I'll
Thank
pick you.
You
up. Okay, good. Folks, right back. This is the Food Chain. 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Well, can we ever be humane enough? Sooner or later, it always gets down to the fact that we have to raise an animal, and we do it in the most humane way possible, and yet we always come down to the fact that we have to kill that animal to eat it. And can we be humane enough to do that? We're going to finish up really quickly with Gail here. Gail, welcome back. Go ahead.
Thank you. On Valentine's Day, I happened to call an associate of mine. He's involved in animal rescue. He said, Gail can't talk right now. I'm rushing to the vet. What had happened is a woman near Ferndale, which, by the way, is a big cattle town in Northern California, was behind a truck that was transporting calves and other animals to a local auction. She witnessed a calf flying off the back and becoming injured in the middle of the road. A woman called animal control. Of course, animal control said, toss the animal to the side of the road, let it die. She picked the animal up, got it to my friend who was a rescuer. The umbilical cord was still attached to this little calf. The calf, according to the vet, was only a few hours old. And the vet ended up having to euthanize this little animal. And so that's, has me questioning, do happy cows really come from California? That mother had a cow, a little calf ripped away from her to be sold for veal. So the the calf's destiny probably was not very good if he did live. The dairy farms have no use for little boy calves that cannot be turned into
So that what you're saying is that there is a certain amount of cruelty inevitable, right? Is that what you're telling
me? Oh, I think you can't get away from the cruelty. I love the program. I wish everybody luck. Thank you, Wayne. We are all working out here to realize that first of all, we humans do not have to eat animals. If we do, we need to get the laws
okay,
tired.
Gail, thank you so much. We're out of time.
Thank you.
I'm going to finish
bye
up
bye.
With our guests. Thank you very much. Eric, you want to respond to that little story there?
Well, obviously, without being there, it's hard to react. But obviously, you know, there are none of us that are involved in animal agriculture that like to see anything like that happen. And here in Iowa, where I'm from, I'd just like to relate this story. We have a huge white-tailed deer population.
Mm-hmm.
And it's actually the largest cause of vehicular homicide deaths in the state of Iowa are
deer.
Automobile accidents with deer. And I'm just wondering if is the Humane Society working on that problem around the country? Because it's certainly inhumane to the human beings that get hit by these deer that are running loose, and it's very inhumane to the deer. And, you know, I guess I see a lot of energy being expended towards animals that are sold for food, and not a lot of energy being expended on some of these other tragic happenings through in everyday life.
Well, Eric, you go to our website, and I urge all listeners to go to our website, humanesociety.org, and you'll see our work on a broad range of issues. Farm animal work constitutes a portion of it, just a portion, but it's vitally important because so many animals are raised for food. It's 10 billion animals raised for food a year. We're focused on letting people know that there are options out there, but also working with producers to stop the most inhumane practices that are
Wayne, let me finish up with one question to you. Sooner or later, you know, we raise things in the most humane way possible, but it always comes down to the fact that we must kill them. Can we do, is it possible to be humane enough? Is it possible?
Well, I personally think that vegetarianism is a tremendous option for people. It's healthy, it's good for the environment, it's good for animals. But most of our members are not going to be vegetarian. I mean, I celebrate those who are, and I personally am.
Okay, out of time. Thank you both, Wayne Pacelli and Eric Nelson. Wish I had about 3 more hours with both of you. Folks, this has been The Food Chain. Stay tuned for next week for more What's Eating What Radio right here on The Food Chain.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.